Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, what an exciting month it's been in the world of astronomy. We've had the Philae lander wake up and then seemingly go back to sleep again. We've had New Horizons fly past Pluto, and we've had the discovery of another planet that might or might not be something like the Earth. More on those later. But the main story of the month has surely been New Horizons passing past tiny Pluto and sending back the first close-ups we've ever had of one of our solar system's outer markers. Joining me to talk about all the stories from this month, Edward Gomez again. Welcome back.
Hi, Chris.
So let's start with Pluto. It's in this tiny world discovered in 1930 by Clyde Tombaugh, and for a long time we've not really known much about it at all.
No, the reason that it was only discovered in 1930 is because it's tiny and it's very, very far away. Almost all of the planets in the solar system we see invisible light, and that light is the light that it reflects from the sun. And because Pluto is so far away and so small, it doesn't reflect much light from the sun, so it's very difficult to see.
But to find out more about Pluto, the New Horizons probe was launched back in 2006. And of course, back then, Pluto was the ninth planet. That changed back then into a dwarf planet.
Yeah, that's right. And some people were quite sad about that. Largely Americans were quite sad about it because Clyde Tombaugh was American, the only American to ever have named a planet. But actually, the solar system we tend to think of as being nine planets and was always nine planets, but it wasn't. 1930, we got this extra planet. In parts of the 19th century, it had a variety of different numbers of planets, as people thought that asteroids were planets and some of the moons around different planets were also planets. So I, for one, am very glad to have a good definition of what a planet is. And now we have eight planets and we have a whole load of dwarf planets, which Pluto is one of.
Yeah, and Pluto certainly doesn't care what we call it.
No.
So New Horizons out to investigate the surface of Pluto, going so fast it just flies by. It had a couple of hours just to fly by. This all happens in the middle of July, so we're now a couple of weeks after the flyby. But to get a better feel for why people are so excited about this mission, I thought I'd speak to a few astronomers and others. About a week before New Horizons' closest approach, I was at the National Astronomy Meeting. Several hundred astronomers gathered in the Welsh seaside town of Llandudno, and I took the opportunity to speak to a few over coffee and lunch about why they're excited about the mission and what it might find on Pluto. I began by speaking to Jane Greaves from the University of St Andrews, who studies the outer solar system, and I asked her why she was so interested in Pluto.
Well, it's really the last world in our solar system that we haven't explored, and the New Horizons spacecraft was launched in 2006. It's the fastest spacecraft we've ever built, basically, so we've had a decade wait to get these fascinating pictures that are coming in of this basically unexplored world.
We're about a week before Encounter right now, so as we record this, what do you think or hope it will find when it passes Pluto?
I think the pictures of the terrain are going to be the most exciting. There may be clues to the fact of how the system formed. So we now know Pluto has one big moon and at least four small moons. And it's thought that that was some sort of cosmic bust-up, like the one that left the Earth with a large moon, but no other small moons. And so the pictures of just the relics of this impact would be great. And all the different colours on the surface, why those happen, which is probably processing of mystery kinds of ice by light from the sun. There are theories like the atmosphere is escaping. It's probably the most fragile atmosphere that exists in the solar system. So to just actually test all these ideas that have been around for a while is super exciting.
Yeah, and now is the time to go and observe Pluto, because it's going away from us, right? So now it has to be now.
Well, it goes away from us quite slowly. So there was a while in the, about the 1970s where it was actually closer to us than the planet Neptune. But it's got a very long and elongated orbit, so it is now going away from us. We're chasing it down. And in fact, one of the ideas around the last few years was, as it cools off, the atmosphere could in fact entirely snow out as a kind of nitrogen snowflakes, and you could get there and find all the atmosphere sitting on the ground laughing at you. Now, that hasn't happened, but that is quite a relief to scientists with the instruments to know there's something there to study.
How would we know there's an atmosphere at all? Because when we look at Pluto through an amateur telescope, you need a fairly big telescope to see it anyway,
yes.
You see a point of light. How do we know it's got an atmosphere?
Well, this was it was realised in the 1980s that as Pluto's moving from our perspective, it occasionally crosses in front of some completely random star in the background. This is a transit observation. It's pretty much the same way as people look for planets around other stars. You lose the light, in this case, the whole star, as Pluto crosses across it, because Pluto's not related to that background star. And it was known from the size of Pluto that this would take, 15 seconds or something. And then the first observations in the 1980s found it took more like 80 seconds. And that must mean there's something else there, a very thin atmosphere that could also take away some of the starlight.
It's now a dwarf planet. It's the way it's categorised. It's one of a number of objects out there. They're out in the outer solar system. They're cold. They're icy. Why do we care about them at all?
They're clues to the origins of the solar system, and we think all the planets were basically formed by a lot of rocks slamming together. But of course, we can't see any relics of this process on the Earth because there's been so much geological activity since. So it's all been washed away by oceans and lava and things. But Pluto is probably much as it was in the beginning. So if we see the terrain that shows, maybe different colours on different sides or giant craters or something, it gives real clues to how you do something as dramatic as slam two objects together to make a planet. So I think it appeals to the sort of action-adventurer side of us astronomers.
And it will presumably, as with most things, raise questions as well, right? We're going to find a lot of stuff a lot of questions we didn't even know we had to ask before that are going to be raised by the New Horizons encounter, and that's exciting.
I think that's really exciting. I mean, you could get up in the morning and see the new pictures, so there was a lot of excitement about a couple of days ago about a big row of black spots. We had no idea they were there on one of the limbs of Pluto. And people are going, well, hang on, why do they all look so similar and they're so similarly spaced apart? And the next day's pictures showed that actually, one of them's a slightly different shape and that kind of thing. So it's really discovery day by day. It's amazing.
Pluto is fascinating to many people, not just astronomers. Jen Gupta from the University of Portsmouth spends a lot of time speaking to school students and visitors. I asked Jen what she was most looking forward to from New Horizons.
I'm mainly looking forward to it for the improved pictures. So a lot of what I do is going into schools and talking to kids about the solar system and the universe. And even the younger kids still ask why I miss out Pluto when I talk about the solar system. And so I explain dwarf planets and everything, but we have really rubbish pictures of it. And I've been really excited watching the better images coming through from New Horizons as it gets closer and closer and closer. So to be able to show them that it's not just this fuzzy blob. And I also do planetarium shows at the Winchester Science Centre. And we do a great show called The Planet Show where we zoom around the solar system, go in and look at the planets in detail. And we just can't go to Pluto because we don't have high enough resolution images of it. So I'm looking forward to Alex, the planetarium officer, being able to put Pluto into the shows for the first time for me to go and fly up to.
And even cosmologists, used to studying galaxies billions of light years away, can get excited about missions like New Horizons. Steve Sargent from the Open University told me why he's excited about the occasion.
Because we are seeing a new world. We are visiting a new world for the first time. It's extraordinary. It's incredible. It's like being part of history. We really are being part of history right now. It's a thrilling time of discovery right now. As to what we will actually see, well, I don't know. Because Pluto is very interesting. It's got an atmosphere that condenses down at some part of the of its year. So we're going to be seeing some very strange, very interesting, very dynamic environment, and trying to unpick what's going on in the surface of this planet will be very exciting, I think.
To many, this is a once-in-a-lifetime event to see the first images of a planet. Here's Megan Argo, a radio astronomer from the University of Manchester.
Well, how often do we get to see a planet for the first time that we've never seen the surface of before? It's just so exciting watching the probe get closer and closer and seeing new features appear on the surface.
And what do you think or hope we might find when it gets there?
Canals? No, I'm kidding. No. that's been mentioned a couple of times this week. I don't know. I think anything we find is going to be exciting, given that we know so little about the planet to start with. Sorry, minor planet.
Dwarf planet, yes.
I had one school kid actually fairly recently say to me, I asked the class, how many planets are there? And this kid put his hand up and went, miss me. I said, yes. And he went, there are eight because Pluto exploded. I said, oh dear, I hope nobody's told New Horizons that.
Excellent. I'm not sure where that student was from, but presumably not from the classroom of Charlie Barkley, a physics teacher at Marlborough College and also an astronomer.
For me, it's quite special because the telescope at Marlborough College at the Blackett Observatory is very old, 1860, but its capabilities were such that in 2005, myself and a group of 12 people actually got to see Pluto by eye as a planet. It was then deplanetized, so I like to think that I'm one of the last people to have seen the planet Pluto. So I'm quite interested to know what it actually looks like.
Do you have any thoughts about what we might find or what you hope we might find when it gets there as it goes past?
I'll keep an open mind, but I suspect we'll find more diversity than we might have expected. And it, as always with these things, I suspect we'll find things we've never even thought about.
New Horizons' glimpses of Pluto are always going to be fleeting, simply because to get there in a decade, the spacecraft is travelling extremely quickly. Simon Green of the Open University and Manuel Grandi of Aberystwyth University are no strangers to the challenges of the space missions, having both worked on numerous space probes. First, here's Simon with a prediction of what this means for the mission.
You know, in order to get there in a reasonable length of time, it means that the flyby speed is very high, and so there's going to be, you know, a very limited number of good images. So I know what's going to happen. Everybody's going to go look at this thing and then say, yeah, but I'd love to see the other side. Isn't it always the way?
Well, and indeed, with Golden Ages, of course, we've just finished MESSENGER.
So this is Mercury, the closest planet to the Sun, the other end of the solar system.
That's right. But you know, I, again, you've got a planet where people thought they knew a lot about it, because that's what you're saying, flown past it. But when you go into orbit, you see completely different things, and you know the whole story changed. You know, formation theories changed. Our appreciation of the exosphere is what MESSENGER saw was very different from what people expected to see. So you're right, you learn a lot more from an orbiter, but nevertheless... Yeah.
But the flyby, first flyby is obviously always exciting, because that's when you get that first close-up view, and then you kind of get the feeling, OK, there's something new we didn't expect. When we design our next mission, this is what we're going to really explore. And then you always find more new things. And I don't think I've ever been disappointed by... Mm. A space mission, because you know the people want you to tell them beforehand all the science you're going to do, because they want to plan and say, you know, how can we pick a mission to Pluto versus some astronomy observatory or opening up a new wavelength range or something. And the whole point is you don't know the answer because you haven't been there, you know. And so anything that you can think of that's great science, you'll do. But you know the end result is going to be better than that, because there'll be all the things you never thought of that suddenly come out to light for the first time.
And you know, the solar system, everything we've seen on it, you know, the moons of Jupiter and the outer planets, you know, nobody ever guessed the richness that you were going to find there.
Yeah.
The sheer difference of environments and the fact that, you know, the physics is the same everywhere, but each one of those moons and planets has mixed that physics together in a different way and got an entirely different environment. It's
I remember a few years ago when I was observing asteroids and writing a proposal, and it came back, you know, you've looked at half a dozen asteroids, why do you need to see any more? You know, and it because they're all the same, aren't they? You know, and I kind of just was dumbfounded for a little while, and then I just said, yeah, and you're observing galaxies, and you've looked at millions of them, and they're all the same anyway, aren't they? You know, tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, it is. There is just such a diversity, and you can't just look at one and say that's the thing. And that's the nice thing about this New Horizons thing, is it's going to, we hope, observe at least two objects. And one of them is a binary, so that's another one for free. You know, and it's... So I think we'll get that first real step change in understanding of the Kuiper Belt, because, you know, everything else has been unresolved.
Well, I mean, you said that the orbiters give you more information. So our first flybys in the Jupiter, the moons in Jupiter, the Jupiter system, were back in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And then I guess we've had a few more missions to the Jupiter system, most of them flybys. And we've got a mission planned by ESA to go and orbit Ganymede, the largest moon, in the 2030s. So that's going to be 60 years from the first flyby to the first orbiter around a Jupiter moon. Do you think we're in the same thing with Pluto in 60 years, which is a long way away, but, you know, it's a 10-year journey, so it's probably not that far away. Are we looking at, do you think, in 60 years, sending an orbiter to Pluto? Do you think?
Well, think about it. 60 years ago, we were talking about launching people into space. It was right at the at the start of the space age. The whole world has turned upside down in 60 years. Who knows what it's going to be like in the next 60? It may be that you can, you know, that give away trips to Pluto with, instead of free dives at Morrison's. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I fear that I might not see it, but I cannot believe that we will see nothing that will want us to go back there and find out more. Just, you know, the human desire to explore is there, and these are things that are accessible with the current technology. Okay, the only thing that stops us doing it all now is money.
Capability, to be honest. Well, I mean, some of these, you know, I mean, do we have the technology really to orbit Pluto now? I mean, do we have the technology to land people on Mars and bring them home again? Unless you spend a lot of money.
Yeah, but that's the key. Because if there's a real will, you will spend a lot of money.
The difficulty with orbiting Pluto is slowing down enough to get into
orbit.
Yeah, it
would take a lot longer than 10 years to get there because you couldn't do... You would have to spend half the time decelerating again. So, you know, and there are easier targets still to go to. In the inner solar system, there's still lots of things ripe for exploration. So, yeah, I think it will happen, but I think it will be quite some way away.
The trip to Pluto is not a short one. With New Horizons launched back in 2006, David Southwood is the former director of space science at the European Space Agency and has been involved in a huge number of missions throughout the solar system. He told me how New Horizons fits into humanity's exploration of our local neighbourhood.
Well, I mean, it must have been conceived 20 years ago, I would guess, in a very different environment to the one we're in now. But if you don't stick to your guns and hold on and build things and tackle, we get nowhere. And we're increasingly going to have long missions. I mean, look at Rosetta. Rosetta is even older. Or look at Cassini, which has been 11 years going around Saturn. Mm. Well, this is the great age of planetary exploration. Somehow we don't quite believe it, but it is. And so, you know, this is one more step. And I think if you took me back 50 years and told me somebody would interview me about a mission going to Pluto, I said, and that's all I ever wanted to hear. Okay? Somehow the magic is going a little because we're doing so many extraordinary things. For me, that's great.
Almost becomes routine, which is, I guess, the goal
in the
end.
Which, of course, you can't let it become routine. I mean, it's... I don't know. For me, it's always going to be exciting. I mean, there's always... Whenever I'm involved in a project, there's always a little bit of me up there with it. I don't know quite whether I can explain that right, but particularly with a planetary mission, you know, there's a little bit of me orbiting Saturn. Come on, that's a wonderful feeling, and that's for me what I just feel so lucky.
Well, that was then, and this is now. Many of the people I spoke to alluded to the unexpected and the surprises that might await us as we flew past, and certainly they were not wrong. New Horizons has successfully flown through the Pluto system, didn't get hit by any small bits of space rock, snapping amazing photos of the surface of this small world and its large companion, Charon, however you want to pronounce
Karen.
It.
Charon.
Yeah. So, Edward, back with you again. We've seen a huge number of surprises from Pluto.
Yeah, there's Pluto, which we thought was a barren world right at the edge of the solar system, actually has quite a lot of features on it. It has plains, it has mountains. The mountains, I think, are probably the most surprising of all, which seem to be 3.5 kilometres high ice mountains. And the reason that people think that they're made of ice, remember we only had a glimpse of Pluto as New Horizons whizzed past, is because of the amount of light that they reflect and also they're 3.5 kilometres high. And really the only thing that we can think of that could form structures that are that big is ice, water ice.
So Pluto's made of about half rock, half ice. It's probably got a rocky core and then this ice on the outside, as well as things like nitrogen ice and methane ice and other things like that. So not just water ice. And as you say, water ice is the only one of those that we think is strong enough to be able to support these massive mountains. But the other ices have some interesting patterns. There's a nice feature that was the dominant part of the photo that New Horizons sent back.
Yes, that's right. It's sort of a heart shape. That looks, I don't know, it looks very nice and welcoming.
Yeah. Now, the thought is that the white material, the bright material, is actually quite possibly nitrogen ice. And one of the interesting features about this is there are no craters visible on this patch. And that tells us something about the surface.
Yeah, that's right. It means that it's relatively fresh and new. Just like after a snowstorm, you can see this beautiful layer of snow with no footprints in it. It means that this layer of ice hasn't had any meteors impacting on it. So there are no craters. And that tells us probably some limits on the age of that particular region.
I mean, they're saying it's less than 100 million years old, and we even said just tens of millions of years old, which, given that we thought Pluto was going to be a relic of the formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago, to see parts of it still changing now, tens of millions of years ago, quite possibly still changing and still evolving, that's astonishing.
Yeah, that's right. You would have thought that this thing would have been left unchanged for its entire history, but it doesn't. Which is one of the fantastic things about this. Also, people think the same about these ice mountains, that they could be a similar age. So Pluto might be going through a lot more changes than we'd given it credit for.
Now, there are several explanations for why this might be. To have what could be nitrogen ice glaciers moving around on the surface, you need some form of heat from beneath. Now, there might be some heat from the interior of Pluto, just enough to generate very weak heat to make these glaciers move. Other thoughts is it's tidal friction with Pluto's moon Charon, which is so large compared to Pluto, about half the size of Pluto, so large that the tides could be very strong. And that might mean that Charon's formation was actually very recent.
Yeah, that's true. And Charon and Pluto seem to be very, very similar. They're a lot more similar than the Earth is to the Moon. And the Earth and the Moon are very similar. They look quite different from space, but actually their chemical composition is very, very similar. And Charon and Pluto seem to be an awful lot more similar. Charon is also enormous. It's far, far bigger, as you said, than our Moon is compared to the Earth. And it's a lot closer. So all of those things combined mean that there's something really weird going on there.
Yeah, so it might mean that Charon is created in some collision actually very recently. Who knows? Now, further investigation will continue going on. We've got something like, the last time I heard, was about 5% of the data back, and that was a couple of weeks after the flyby. It's so far away, it takes so long to get the images and all the other data back to Earth, so it's going to take months to get the rest back.
Yeah, that's right. And this is always a problem with space missions. We saw this with Rosetta as well, that they've got a tiny little satellite dish antenna which is beaming back at sort of dial-up, not broadband, but dial-up internet rates. So it does take a long, long time for the data to get back. And if you've seen these images, they're enormous images. And it's not only image data that's coming back from these probes.
Yeah, hopefully we'll find out what the surface is made of, which will tell us more about how old the surface is and possibly the processes that really are going on, rather than at the moment, which is some of it is sort of educated guesswork, if you like, from low-resolution images. It's going to be a fascinating story over the next few months and years to see this come out.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, Pluto hasn't been the only thing in the news. There was also a discovery about a week ago now of another Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of a star. Now, I say another because we've had this story before. This is Kepler-452b. Why is it different to all these stories before?
Well, people are saying that it's the closest analog to our solar system, to Earth in our solar system. The star that Kepler-452b is orbiting around is very, very close to the Sun.
In its properties,
it's actually very far away from the Sun, but it's very close in its properties. It's the same type of star. It's roughly the same temperature and color. I say slightly older. It's about 1.5 billion years older than our Sun. But actually, that probably doesn't mean too much because our Sun will stay largely the same for billions of years. So that's not too much of a problem. And the planet that was found is in this habitable zone. So this is a region in space around a star where water can exist in a liquid phase. So it's not too close so that it would be gas, and it's not too far away so that it would be too cold and all be frozen. And people say that this is what, you know, the places that we should look for life. But I have severe reservations about it. I mean, it just so happens that the star is very, very similar to the Sun, but the planet itself is 60% bigger than the Earth. It could be rocky. We've no idea whether there is actually water on it. It seems that this solar system doesn't have any other planets, certainly no other big planets like we have in our solar system. We have Jupiter and Saturn, which are colossal, and thinking about the formation of our solar system, they could be responsible, particularly Jupiter, could be responsible for sending wet things towards the inner solar system, like comets and asteroids which had water on, which could be responsible for where the water on the Earth comes from. So this planet, although it's roughly in the right place and it's roughly the right size, I very much doubt that it's anything like Earth at all.
And we simply won't know until we... Well, it's going to be a long time before we get any more information on a planet this small. All we know is its size. We don't know anything about its mass, its density, as you say. We don't know anything about its properties. Is there a worry that everyone is going to get tired of these stories, and then finally, it's a bit like Crying Wolf, right? Finally, when there is a story about a properly Earth-like planet, and no one's going to listen.
Well, I really want there to be some hard evidence that a planet is capable of sustaining life. And the way that we can do that is by looking at the atmospheres of exoplanets. This is a really, really difficult thing to do because you're looking at something really faint next to something really bright. And the thought of actually looking at the atmosphere around something that's that faint is quite a technical challenge. However, we can do that a little bit. We can use telescopes to look at the difference in colour of different exoplanets. From that you can infer maybe the atmospheric properties. That's still not very precise at all. But you can, with new technology, with new types of instruments, you can actually probe the elements which are in these atmospheres. And then I think you'd look for things that we consider man-made, things like CFC gases, or perhaps the presence of things like methane, things that you wouldn't normally expect if there were no life.
And again, that's going to be a while coming. As you say, it's pretty inaccurate or pretty imprecise at the moment because it's so difficult. But hopefully one day.
Yes, that's right. Hopefully one day. There are various different people who are interested in this in the UK. And here in Cardiff, there's a group who are very interested in looking at the atmospheres of exoplanets.
Now, exoplanets we can observe with space telescopes from hundreds or thousands of light years away, but there are a lot of missions, like the New Horizons mission, which has gone to Pluto, that are orbiting planets in our solar system. It was mentioned earlier that we're in a golden age of exploration, so I think we've got Cassini orbiting Saturn, we've got New Horizons just gone past Pluto. I think I count 4 spacecraft orbiting Mars and 2 on its surface. Got Dawn orbiting Ceres and looking at bright white spots there, which are fascinating, and we've just finished with 2 missions orbiting, a mission each orbiting Mercury and Venus. We've got the Juno mission on the way to Jupiter. And of course, coming up in about a decade's time or so, we've got the JUICE mission, which is this European Space Agency's mission to go and study the moons of Jupiter.
Yeah, that's right. And JUICE, well, JUICE is probably more like 15 years away. It's only just being given the green light to start building the different instruments on that, with Airbus winning the contract to make the spaceship. Now, the spaceship is only one aspect. Obviously, it's a very important aspect, but a mission wouldn't be anything without the instruments on board, and those will be made by probably largely universities all across Europe.
Yeah, and hopefully some UK universities getting involved, and there's a selection process for those as well. So, again, in the next decade or so, we'll see what's happening with those. But we really are in a bit of a golden age for astronomy. Of course, if you're wanting to find out more about what's going on, you can go and hear people talk about it. And Edwards, the day after this is first broadcast, you're doing just that. You're talking about some astronomy.
Yes, that's right. I'm giving a Science of Doctor Who talk in the National Museum and Galleries in Cardiff. So on Friday, the 31st of July at 6:30, if you are in the neighbourhood, have a look at the Eventbrite website and see if there are any tickets left.
And then next month, in August, on the 24th of August, Mark McCochrane, who's a senior science advisor in the European Space Agency, is going to be coming and talking about Rosetta and the Philae lander and what we've found out about so far from that very exciting mission and the results that are going to come. So again, check out the Eventbrite page. That's going to be in the National Museum in Cardiff, about 6:45 on Monday the 24th of August. So do come and check that out if you're interested. Well, thanks, Edward. There certainly is a lot going on this month. And, of course, you can also go and look at the sky yourself. With me, Hugh Lang, back again, to talk about what's in the sky this month. So the planets are kind of really dwindling. So Mercury, Venus and Jupiter have been around in the evening, but they're kind of gone now.
That's right. Jupiter and Venus and Mercury setting very close to the sun at the moment, so not really visible in the evening. But, of course, Venus will become a morning object. And by the end of the month, will be pretty obvious for the early risers, of course.
Yeah, so it's passing in front of the sun, and will be the other side of it, so rise before the sun by the end of the month.
That's right. By the end of the month, it'll be about 1.5 hours before sunrise. It will be possible. Well, it'll be very easy to see. It'll be very, very bright as well.
For the early risers.
For the early risers, 5:30 in the morning, yeah.
In the evening, we've still got Saturn, but it's starting to disappear into the twilight.
It's well past its best, unfortunately. It was never very good anyway, since it's so low in the sky. But the rings are open at about 24 degrees, so telescopically, it's still worth looking at.
Yep, so if you've got a telescope, well worth having a shot at. We can skip on to things that you don't need a telescope for, and that's the Perseid meteor shower, which happens every year.
That's right, it's one of the big showers of the year. One of the favourites, of course. They'll be peaking roughly at about 100 metres an hour in a dark sky, and it will be dark sky because it'll be very close to a new moon, which occurs on August the 14th. Generally, the meteor shower goes on for quite a period. It starts at July the 17th and goes on to August the 24th. But, of course, they're low counts. It's only really when we get to the peak numbers really do rise, which will be the 11th and 12th in actual fact this year. However, the Society will be holding an observing session on Tuesday, 11th of August at Dufferin Gardens.
That's the Cardiff Astronomical Society.
That's right, if weather permits, of course. And that'll be going on from about 8:30 till, well, probably about midnight.
And if you can't get to Dufferin Gardens for that, then you can just go out. If you've got not too many streetlights around or house lights around, then go out in your back garden or to some dark field, top of a hill or something. Lie back, make yourself comfortable, dress up warm because it'll be cold. in the middle of the night. And stay outside, let your eyes adapt for maybe 20 minutes. Just stay looking up at the sky. If you've got a lounger or something, you can sit
on. Yes, face it towards the north. Look for Perseus, the constellation of Perseus. No. Obviously, that's where the radiant point is, so that's where they all emanate from. So good chance of seeing them.
You'll see them all over the sky, I imagine.
Generally,
coming
yes.
away from that.
They are quite bright, so they do travel. They have fairly good trails.
So it should be well worth having a look at. And, of course, these are largely things the size of a grain of sand burning up in the atmosphere.
That's right. Very, very tiny. Basically just cometary debris, in this particular case, from Comet Swift-Tuttle. So it looks bits of comet, basically.
Yeah. And as the Earth passes through its trail, we see the bright flashes as they burn up in the atmosphere. The best time to look at them, strictly speaking, after midnight, gets better as we're in the leading
edge. Yes, they
say
typically just before sunrise is actually the best time to look for them, but of course that's very early in the morning. Most people tend not to want to watch at that time of day.
But the later in the night you can, the better they'll appear. But the Perseids are always good for going to look at. Relatively warm nights, of course. So
that's right. Yeah. Pretty short nights as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, something to look forward to. Hugh, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
And thanks as well to Edward Gomez and to everyone who gave me their thoughts on New Horizons and Pluto. You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.